for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Secretary of State Kerry expresses utter disbelief at letter from GOP senators to Iran. Hillary Clinton defends her use of private email, and more problems in Ferguson, Missouri. Joining me for the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup, John Dickerson of Slate and CBS, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, and John Prideaux of The Economist. And throughout the hour, you can not only listen to the program, you can see all of our guests on our live video stream at drshow.org. And welcome to all of you.
Great to be
Thanks,
here.
Diane.
Good to see you all. John Dickerson, in the wake of the Justice Department report last week, you had an exodus of officials in Ferguson, now two police shot there. What's the latest?
Well, the latest is that the two police were shot. There is still an extensive manhunt going on for the shooters. And now with tensions, as you know, the tensions had kind of cooled a little bit. This shooting took place after the police chief resigned. And there's a lot of there's a view that the shooters were not a part of the protest going on Thursday evening. But now with tensions running high, or I guess it was Wednesday evening, with tensions running high, the state and county police have taken over the security in Ferguson.
And you certainly had strong words from both President Obama and the Attorney General, Eric Holder.
Yes, the Attorney General said that whoever did this were punks, and the president described them as criminals. It really is sort of a mystery here, because things really did seem to be going in a direction, I think, that everybody was feeling pretty positive about in Ferguson, again, with the sort of house cleaning and the, you know, people who had been responsible for some of the problems identified in the justice report. So it is unclear why someone would do something like this at this moment. And again, I guess we're not going to have the answer to that until this manhunt turns up with someone.
But, you know, John, it would seem that there are other racial incidents going on around the country. You think about what happened in Atlanta when an unarmed black man was shot. You think about Colorado. You think about Wisconsin. I mean, it seems to be spreading.
I think that's right. I think there's also an element of after Ferguson and after the incident in New York last year, that when unarmed black men typically are killed by the police, it now looks like it's sort of part of a pattern, and so people report on it. And in a way, that's progress, because attention to these sorts of things tends to help. And actually, I think you could see, at least in Wisconsin and Georgia, where you had shootings of unarmed black folks, the police departments there have gone about their investigations in a different way to how they would previously. They've brought in independent agencies to investigate the police shootings. And I think one of the lessons from police departments around America is, if you take officer-involved shootings very seriously, you tend to get fewer officer-involved shootings. So in a way, though obviously these deaths are terribly sad, you know, you can point to some progress there.
You know, one of the downside, the problem of the shooting, obviously the two officers who were hurt in Ferguson, it is bad on its face. But it also happened at a time where they were getting into the second and third generation conversation in Ferguson, which was, an event happened and there are the facts of that event. But then there is also this systemic racism that was inside the police force. And they were working through that systemic question. The idea of, you know, it's not a simple cut and dried issue here, although obviously many people are portraying all that's going on in Ferguson in very clear terms, but it's not. And so they were getting to that part of the conversation. Now with the shootings, everything's kind of slipped back in the dialogue. This is really it's a proxy discussion about race in America that was a little bit further along, and now these shootings feel like they've slipped it back.
And And again, I think that, you know, once this manhunt yields whatever it is going to yield, you know, I think that's going to be the context in which progress or lack of progress is viewed.
John Perdue.
Yeah, one of the sad things about the shootings, in addition to the fact that these poor officers are injured, is that one of the strong criticisms of the Ferguson Department in the Department of Justice report was that it tended to view legitimate protests as criminal activities. And, of course, you know, this is a protest that, you know, turned ugly in some sense, and it's not going to help that. And as John says, it tends to drag the argument back towards one of black against white, whereas actually I thought the most interesting stuff in the Department of Justice report on Ferguson is the extent to which the police department had essentially been turned into a revenue-raising arm of the government. And actually, if you look at other cities in Missouri, or not even cities, other, you know, kind of smaller places in Missouri, there are a whole load of them where traffic stops account for more than 30% of 30% of revenue, which is supposed to be illegal in Missouri. And some of those places are predominantly white, some of those places are predominantly black. But unfortunately, as John says, this has dragged us back to a black versus white, you know, argument.
And while all this is going on in Missouri, you've got what happened at the University of Oklahoma with fraternity members of SAE coming out with racial songs, and even the house mother singing the same songs, and David Boren, the president of the University of Oklahoma, taking very swift and sharp action.
Yeah. What was horrifying about this video is that Sigma Alpha Epsilon is a fraternity that prides itself on the fact that it goes back to the antebellum period. But, you know, it's a big national organization. So the question is this part of fraternity culture, or is this just a few sort of rotten apples? But the video of these kids is they were singing a song that had several verses and that they clearly had sung before and that had clearly been taught to them. So, again, I think here's the question. Is this part of the culture?
Yeah.
Or is this just some sort of, you know, aberrant group of young men?
Well, the feeling, the statement, the emotion behind David Boren's statement certainly made it clear what he thought.
He said he was sickened and that he couldn't eat or sleep after learning about it. And there is, I mean, just to focus here for a minute, after the 50th anniversary of the march in Selma, to see people singing with glee about the most horrible episode in American history, with glee, is sickening. And when we talk about where this problem lies, you know, it lies perhaps at one tiny place in not having taught them their history. To sing about lynching is just, Boren's physical revulsion at this is the right response. The words should literally not be able to come out of your mouth. And that's what made this such a shocking video. And as Karen said, it wasn't just one person. It was a whole busload of people singing without a song sheet. And that's what made it so disgusting.
So what it makes you wonder, certainly it's not confined to Ferguson, Missouri, or St. Louis, Missouri, or Colorado, Wisconsin, or even Georgia. There it is in Oklahoma. So it is as though the country needs to take a broader, better, more careful look at attitudes regarding racism in this country. How do you see it, John?
I think it comes into so many different aspects of American life. And, you know, I think a good place to start, it's the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War this year. I think some Civil War history classes, you know, some attention paid to what happened in Reconstruction and afterwards would be useful. And then perhaps we wouldn't get people singing about lynchings. However, I do think it's different. I mean, the Sigma Alpha Epsilon people singing, that looked like a sort of question of kind of pure sort of ignorance and stupidity. I think with the police shootings, there's a different thing going on. I think there's almost a sort of unconscious bias there on the part of some police officers. In some cases, you have conscious racism, and I'm not sure there's a huge amount you can do about that other than fire those officers. But on the part of most of these officers, I think what's happening is they're coming across people in their work lives. They're arresting African Americans in places where African Americans are a majority, like Ferguson. And that is creating a sort of picture in their heads of, you know, these folks are criminals and, you know, we don't treat them very well. And so I think it's a different, you know, it looks like it's all the same phenomenon, but I think in a way it's lots of disparate phenomena that kind of look similar, if that makes sense.
But I think we've got to take a careful look at it, and not only in the attitudes out there, but perhaps in our own unconscious racial bias. That's how I see it. Anyhow, John Prideaux of The Economist, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, John Dickerson of Slate Magazine, and political director for CBS. A short break here. When we come back, we'll talk about other news of the week. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CA Technologies, who believes that in the application economy, every business is in the software business. CA makes software to empower enterprises and help them thrive. More information is at ca.com. From PwC, the right people to get the extraordinary done. Learn more at pwc.com/extraordinary. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all. On the web at rwjf.org.
Welcome back. Remember that you can watch the Friday News Roundup live. You can go to drshow.org and click on Watch Live. We've had a couple of tweets on the SAE, the fraternity that sang such outrageous songs on the bus. And two students have now been expelled from the University of Oklahoma. Here are the tweets. There is evidence the SAE chant dates back to the 1980s and probably earlier, and from across the nation. It's endemic. Another tweet, numerous SAE alums have reported their chapter sang this song. It's national. It's been going on for years or perhaps decades. So let's move on now to Secretary of State Kerry testifying at a Senate hearing on authorization to combat ISIS. He was certainly critical of the letters sent by 47 senators, Karen, to Iran's supreme leader, telling him that with the stroke of a pen, any agreement they entered into could be wiped out by the next president.
That's right. Now, and again, this hearing was supposed to be on the process towards getting an authorization for use of force against ISIS, but essentially the hearing got hijacked by this letter that a number of senators, led by the new senator from Arkansas, Tom Cotton, had sent to the Iranian leaders, basically telling them, you know, any agreement you sign is worthless once this president is out of office. This letter was signed by 47 Republican senators, but what is, I think, even more significant is the degree to which the entire bandwagon of potential Republican presidential candidates for 2016 is jumping aboard that. Senator Rubio and Senator Paul were at that hearing with Secretary Kerry and expressed support for it. Senator Cruz and Lindsey Graham have signed the letter, and there have been expressions of support from everybody from Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, Rick Perry of Texas, Jeb Bush, Scott Walker. So basically, it's not just 47 senators, as aggressive as that has been, but it does seem to be the entire sort of Republican establishment jumping on this.
The Secretary of State Kerry said he was in utter disbelief when he read that letter, John.
Well, he could have been in that state simply for the claims made in the letter. So there were a couple of claims made in the letter. One was the context of the letter was that these senators were writing to to whom it wasn't quite sure. It wasn't addressed to a specific person, but we're writing to the Iranians and saying, here's how our constitution works. Any agreement has to be ratified by 2/3 of the Senate, and the next president can revoke this with the stroke of a pen. So the problem is that this is not a treaty we're talking about here, and so therefore cannot be ratified or not ratified by the Senate. In fact, that's the whole point of the anger behind the 47 signatories in the Senate, which is they feel like they're being cut out of a deal and that the deal will be done and they won't have any ability to change the terms of the deal. So the frustration that is legitimate, and the administration has cut them out in large measure in this case, that frustration exists. But then to claim in the letter that they have all this power obviously contradicts the frustration that's the heart of the letter writing.
And
then the
second... But go ahead.
Well, John. The other point is that nothing can be revoked. Congress does have some power on the sanctions that Congress imposed upon Iran, but the president has lots of power on other sanctions, and so the second claim of the letter is not true either.
Yesterday, John Bellinger, the former legal advisor to the Department of State and to the National Security Council, pointed out those very errors in the letter, saying that they just showed that they didn't quite understand what they were writing.
Well, also, this suggestion that this agreement that is some sort of far-fetched use of executive power unilaterally on the part of the president is also not true. There was a story a couple of days ago in the New York Times by Peter Baker where he pointed out that since the 1930s, 94% of all agreements that have been made with foreign countries, 94% have been executive agreements, that only 6% have been treaties that were actually ratified by the Senate. So these kinds of negotiations are, you know, they're the norm.
The other thing that struck me as interesting about the letter, Diane, is that you read it and you think, okay, well, what's the alternative? What's the plan that the Republicans in the Senate or the likely presidential candidates from the GOP are proposing? And, you know, Tom Cotton was asked about this, and he said the only thing that's acceptable to Senate Republicans is for Iran to give up its pursuit of nuclear weapons, which, by the way, it denies it is pursuing, with no strings attached, which, of course, is a terrific aim, but there's, you know, no idea at all how you would get there. You know, nobody in the administration would dispute that would be a wonderful place to get to. But Republicans do not have a plan to get there. And, you know, short of The only way you could do that, seems to me, would be to kind of invade and occupy the country, and nobody's talking about that. So it seems to me a kind of fundamentally unserious approach to what's a very, very important foreign policy question.
What's also interesting here is it's a development in the way we look at the Senate, which is that this letter was written by a freshman senator. In a previous generation, a freshman senator wouldn't be able to get their voice heard. Now, that might have been a problem with the institution, but you usually had to gain some standing. You had to become Jesse Helms as the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee to have standing in your party and in the other party. And in this case, this letter and those who signed it overtook the process, the sort of careful process that Senator Corker of Tennessee, a Republican, was trying to put together to bring Democrats on board to say when an ultimate agreement was reached, if there is an agreement between the administration and the Iranians, to push back against that. And Corker was kind of doing it the old way, the old-fashioned way, where you bring Democrats in. And what, going back to what Karen said about the currency in the Republican Party, is for, as Dan Dresner wrote about in the Washington Post, is for disruption. It's for whoever can, and Ted Cruz has done this very well, Tom Cotton is doing it well, it's for whoever can beat up the sort of stupidity of Washington, and that everybody rushes to that, because in the Republican Party right now, that gains you lots of currency, and in the public as a whole, people are not thinking government is doing great things.
But what about the world as a whole? How does the world react when it sees a president's authority, his place in the government, undermined?
Well, one problem here is that if these talks now do fall apart, and Secretary Kerry is either headed for or already arrived in Switzerland for the next, possibly last gasp of these talks, if they do fall apart, it's going to be a lot harder to blame the Iranians for it.
My impression is the world doesn't really understand the U.S. Constitution and finds these things a bit puzzling. It doesn't really understand who's really in charge of American foreign policy. But I think also, to some extent, people look at this and the letter looks like a sort of plan that was sort of dreamt up by some people in a bar. You know, we don't like the president's Iran foreign policy. What should we do? I know. Let's write a letter to the Ayatollah and tell him to read the U.S. Constitution. What a great plan that would be. And then it actually happens. You know, it's amazing.
Well, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and there is a bit of this, obviously, also, that is umbrage taking on the part of the White House, which is, you know, senators write letters all the time and they get ignored thoroughly. And so there was some sort of fainting couch action here where the administration is saying, oh, my, this is such a breach of protocol and all of that, in order to gain currency for their own position.
But on the other hand, we are in a very sensitive place with these negotiations. Karen, go back to the fact that Secretary Kerry was testifying because he wanted to get authorization for U.S. troops to move to support those fighting against ISIS.
Yeah, one of the interesting issues that was talked about in the hearing, the part of it that was actually on topic, was the fact that it's unclear what kind of commitment we're talking about here. And Secretary Kerry and the other officials who were testifying, including Defense Secretary Carter, said that, for instance, they can't make a guarantee that it's a three-year commitment, but they can't guarantee that that's the end of it, that they can actually do the job in 3 years. And I think that is something that is, you know, of no
because
small.
Congress doesn't want another open-ended conflict.
Nor does the country.
Nor does the country.
That's right. And so that was the big concern on one side. The other concern that Chairman Corker had was there were limitations. If the hands of the president were tied too much, for example, in Syria, where the United States is trying to find partners on the ground to replicate what it's doing in Iraq, Corker was concerned that whoever those freedom fighters are in Syria, if the United States partners with them to fight ISIL, then after that battle is won, whenever that may be, there was there was no suggestion in this authorization that the U.S. would then protect the people who had fought with the United States, and that they would, in fact, perhaps prescribe the president from doing anything to protect those people. And so his argument was, why would anybody partner with the United States in fighting ISIL if the minute success is determined by the United States bolts and these people are left to fend for themselves?
So moving on to another subject. Hillary Clinton, former Secretary of State, answered a few questions at the UN about her use of a private email account that went directly to her home. Did she do enough to stem criticism?
I don't think she did, really, and I don't think we'll know quite how much damage this has done her. For a while. I mean, it's one of these stories that journalists love because her press conference really raised as many questions as it answered. I mean, her defense essentially was that it was much more convenient for her to use her private email. And a secondary defense, which I thought was a powerful one, actually, was that, you know, sort of previous secretaries of state have done similar things. I think there have been reports that Colin Powell also used a personal email address and so on. But then, you know, the idea that it was just more convenient doesn't, you know, entirely hold water as far as I can see. And of course, if you're somebody who's suspicious of Hillary Clinton anyway, the fact that she and her staff decided which of her emails were private and which were work and deleted all the private ones, you know, makes you even more suspicious and, you know, and so on and so forth.
John Prideaux of The Economist, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Karen.
Well, I think that there were a number of areas of concern. I mean, yes, they were talking about the Colin Powell, but what she did was in direct contradiction of the marching orders that were given to every single official in this administration, which was that for business purposes, use a government email, and in those cases where that is not possible, make sure that it is archivable onto the government servers in real time. She did not do that. And I think that a couple of things were of concern to Democrats. One is that it took her a week to come back, even to get as far as this news conference. I mean, this is, you might remember, her husband's campaign in 1992 was known for its rapid response. James Carville used to walk around with a T-shirt in the campaign headquarters that said, "Speed kills." And it also goes to, I think, some impulses on Hillary Clinton's part that have always given her problems, the kinds of unforced errors we saw, for instance, when she tried to write health care policy with a 500-member task force in secret, or when she refused to turn over the Whitewater documents. A lot of people in the Clinton White House thought that that would have been a two-day story, that it would have bored the media to death had they been able. Instead, it spawned an independent counsel and Ken Starr and the entire investigation that ultimately led to the impeachment of Bill Clinton. So Hillary Clinton talks about transparency, but all of her impulses take her in the opposite direction.
John.
This was a tricky bit of business because Hillary Clinton doesn't have a campaign team set up and didn't have easy, good answers because, as Karen said, what she did went around both the letter and the spirit of the law. And the first response from the Clinton camp had been that she had done everything in keeping with the letter and the spirit of the law. So there wasn't much clear running room for her to say for her to kind of give a simple explanation without having to resort to a lot of carefully worded language and then a lot of ignoring of questions. And the problem here for Secretary Clinton is that essentially her argument is, trust me, I handled these emails in a way that was thoroughly in keeping with the way they're supposed to be, even though I didn't follow the rules the way they're supposed to be followed.
But in fairness, John, didn't the rules about whether she could use a private email server come into effect after she left office?
No, there were rules that did come into effect to sharpen and make it more clear. But in 2009, the regulation was you may indeed keep a private email account, but everything that you do in that private email account must then be archived on servers and systems inside the government. And that's the key thing, is that it was not inside. And there's a question over the duration. In other words, if you sent a personal email, did you have to archive it in the system immediately, or was there a period of time it could wait? Certainly, though, the period of time to wait was not 6 years. And by the way, she turned them over only when the State Department came to her and said, please turn these over.
So how well do you think she managed the uproar?
Not well, but on the other side is what she really didn't want to do is turn over her server. So if it's between managing it poorly and doing something you really don't want to do, she took the least bad option. I think, does this live? I think people will evaluate her trustworthiness, and this is about trust because she's asking people to trust her that she handled these emails correctly. So then the claims, you measure up what she said against the facts of the case, and many of her claims are not, they don't stand up. So that's a problem. Candidates need to be considered trustworthy by voters.
Do you think she might turn over the server at some point?
Well, she has said that she's deleted. I think, wasn't it something like half the emails? She said, including emails with her husband, but then it was later revealed that her husband's only sent 2 emails ever, and those were while he was president. So, no, we'll never see those emails.
All right. We'll take a short break here, and when we come back, it's time for you to weigh in. Give us a call. Send us an email. I look forward to speaking with you.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Emma, email marketing for the modern brand, featuring email marketing software, automation tools to send personalized messages, and built-in analytics on desktop and mobile devices. Learn more at myemma.com. And from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, working to improve the quality of people's lives by supporting the performing arts, the environment, medical research, and child well-being. Information is available at ddcf.org.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Iraqi forces make progress, taking Tikrit back from ISIS. Iran's supreme leader condemns a letter from Republican senators. And Venezuela's president lashes out at the U.S. in response to new sanctions. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. You can watch our Friday News Roundup as well as listen by going to drshow.org and click on Watch Live right now. Let's take a call from Jim in Carrollton, Texas. You're on the air.
Oh, happy Friday, everybody. Karen said something that I disagree with. She said that she thought these talks were probably scuttled by this. And I think just the opposite. I think the president just got a complete victory here. The Republicans inadvertently handed him everything he wants. Here's why I say that. The sanctions are effective because a number of countries are involved with them. All President Obama has to do is an executive order suspending enforcement of the sanctions, pending performance of the treaty by Iraq, by Iran. And if he does that, and all the other countries agree, the sanctions are off, and they're not coming back on.
What do you think, Karen?
Well, I think there are a lot of people on both sides who don't necessarily want to see the sanctions come off. But what I was specifically referring to was if there is no deal, that it's going to be harder to blame the Iranians for there not being a deal as in these negotiations than it might have been before, you know, a bunch of senators stepped into the middle of it.
All right. To Michael in St. Louis, Missouri, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity. My comment is in regard to the fines and citations that people in Ferguson and many other St. Louis County municipalities within the county are subject to daily. We had a highway, you can reference the map, I-170 that drove from South County through North County and touched many, many, many of these municipalities. And it's just like the court system and the police departments lined up on either side of the road for their opportunity to tax the commuters that use that highway. It's just a long, sad story in St. Louis County for the amount of municipal courts that operate. Thank you for the opportunity once again. I'll listen up.
Thanks for calling. And you mentioned the cost that said
it's. Well, that's right. I think one of the most shocking things to me in the DOJ's report on Ferguson was the detailing of how the municipal court had essentially been set very aggressive financial targets year on year to raise revenue by fining citizens in Ferguson, and indeed had sort of boasted about exceeding them. It made me wonder how widespread this is. I mean, I think one thing that happened with city finances after the financial crisis was that they ended up trying to make up for lost revenue in other areas. And actually, I was writing about this week, so I came across an article from 2010 in Police Chief magazine, which is not a publication I knew about before, which was all about, you know, kind of creative ways for police forces to raise revenues, in the absence of money from property taxation or what have you. And actually, one of the things that was mentioned was, you know, a 50% increase in fines. Another thing that was mentioned was using the police department department's name for branding and advertising, which I don't think will be happening in Ferguson anytime soon. But, I think some of this may have happened elsewhere.
We haven't talked about Secret Service, which seems to be having continuing problems, John Dickerson.
Yeah. So two Secret Service members, including the number two on President Obama's security detail, came back from a going-away party of a colleague and crashed, allegedly crashed their car into the barricade while a bomb investigation was actually going on. And they were some of the Secret Service agents at the scene who were investigating the bomb wanted to give them a breathalyzer, wanted to give the driver of the vehicle a breathalyzer. And he was told to stand down by a supervisor, and they were just sent home, one hopes, in an Uber car or by public transportation for fear of endangering more members of the citizenry. And so this is yet another black eye for the Secret Service, which has had a string of them over the last several months.
Where does it go from here, Karen?
Well, one thing that this does and is it raises a lot of questions about the new director of the Secret Service, Joseph Clancy. Now, there had been recommendations that an outsider be brought in. Instead, they picked a veteran who is particularly close to the president. And he was also good friends with one of the men who's under investigation. So the question is whether this is the guy to really shake up the culture. And the second thing that is absolutely mystifying is why, at a moment when this agency is under the kind of microscope that it is under, why would these senior supervisors at the White House complex decide to just sort of let these guys go?
John Perdue.
I don't want to be too Panglossian about this, but one of the things that strikes me reading the revelations about the Secret Service that Karen's paper has, the Post has pursued, you know, very aggressively, is that it's hard to avoid the inference that a lot of these Secret Service agents sort of seem bored a lot of the time. You know, they get up to these sort of capers because it seems like they don't sort of have enough to do. And maybe that's a great thing. You know, their number one job, I suppose, is to, you know, kind of protect the president. And if there are not, you know, if these folks don't feel like they have a lot of work on their hands, then maybe that's a good thing. I mean, obviously it's inexcusable and they should not be, you know, driving through crash barriers and bomb investigations while allegedly intoxicated.
Well, and we should say they had been at a party for someone else who was leaving the Secret Service, Karen.
Yeah, I just, like I said, this the whole thing, and they, you know, it took days before Congress was notified that this had happened. You just wonder how many times do these things have to happen?
Do you expect Clancy to keep his job, John?
I don't know. I don't have any reporting on that, so I can't really guess. I mean, it is not good. And as Karen says, the connection between Clancy and one of the alleged bad drivers here is that is a problem.
All right. To Scott in Commerce, Texas. You're on the air.
Hello. I was wondering if your panel thought the funding behind Tom Cotton is important in understanding his motives. And if so, why aren't people talking about it more? Thank you.
The funding behind Tom Cotton, John Dickerson.
I'm guessing it's a, I guess that's a maybe a reference to donors in the Republican community who care a great deal about Israel and therefore give money to Republican candidates. And therefore this as a strong, I mean, any in the conversation about this potential deal with Iran, those in the conservative movement who line up very strongly behind Israel and its current prime minister want to do anything possible to scuttle the administration's deal. And therefore, one way to play to that crowd, if you're conservative, I'm intuiting what the questioner is asking here, one way to play to that crowd would be to really show yourself out there fighting hard to break this deal.
All right. To Joe in Venice, Florida. Hi there.
Good morning. I thank your producer for putting me through.
Sure.
My comment is not a political one, but I'm hoping a technical one. When the secretary was trying to explain about using her private email, I think she suggested that when she sent from her private cell phone a message to anyone in the State Department, that it was automatically archived because it was received on a State Department cell phone. And the question of why she didn't separately archive it, she kind of said it was already done. Now, I'm not sure about this, but I think every ingoing or outgoing from a State Department cell phone is automatically archived.
Yeah.
It is every ingoing and outgoing to a government account is archived. But the question is, you know, first of all, who else would she have been talking to in these emails about issues that might have been related to her duties as Secretary of State? We also don't know whether she was communicating with other State Department employees on their private email accounts. Again, it is the beginning to end. This has been sort of a, you know, take my word for this situation.
John.
Yeah, the system that Joe mentions is what's supposed to be happening, and what's not supposed to happen is just leave it up to the employee. And Secretary Clinton said, well, no, that's the case. Employees are allowed to make these decisions about what's personal, what's private. To the extent that they are, it's because the existing system believes that they are, that everything that they're sending is being automatically archived. So for the few emails on which they have to make a decision, they can decide whether it's personal or not. But that's because that means that the law is in play or the regulation is in place that has everything captured. In Secretary Clinton's case, nothing was captured. So it's in fact the exact opposite of what regular people have
John
to do.
John Perdue.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's suggesting, I don't think even Secretary Clinton was suggesting that, you know, any State Department employee could just opt not to use a government email address and just use their own private email instead. So unfortunately, you know, come back to the point that Karen made earlier, it does look like, you know, it's the one rule for the Secretary of State and another for everyone else, and that's obviously damaging.
John Perdue, Karen Tamulty, John Dickerson, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And let's go to Daphne in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania. Hi there.
Good morning. Whenever I hear about the criminal behavior by fraternities, the media often refers to them as the Greeks. Now, I am a Greek American. I was born in Greece, and I love the Greek alphabet. So I vehemently want these organizations to stop using the Greek alphabet to identify themselves, because I find that very insulting, you know, like they're saying something about the Greeks, you know. Why are they using the Greek names? Maybe they did that in England in the old days in the universities, but there's no reason for that to be done here.
All right. Thanks for your call. And following up on that, please, this is an email from Mia in Maryland, who says, please cease the narrative about there being only a few rotten apples when it comes to racist beliefs being a problem. At the University of Oklahoma, racism is a real problem in the U.S., floating just under the surface throughout the country. These students got caught on tape, but it's not a shock to African Americans. And here's another from Andy, and I surely don't know the answer to this. He says, despite how disgusting their speech was, I've read there's a strong First Amendment defense for the fraternity members who were expelled since it's a public university. Are we likely to see the school's decision challenged in court, John Dickerson?
Well, it is an interesting First Amendment question. I'm not a lawyer, so I'll take the other part of it, which is that people argue that the reason to have a robust, free, and public speech is that the damage to these ideas comes from when they are said out loud, and everybody is reminded how repugnant they are and how And then in its moment to talk about our history again in a way that people sometimes forget. And then, in fact, there's a benefit to having even the ugliest speech around. But to your original question, Diane, I would think that that one of the students would have to claim standing, have standing, and therefore the lawsuit would have to be done in their name. And I don't get the sense that these two expelled students want to do anything other than hide for a very long time and try to forget this episode.
Karen.
Yeah, certainly. And they and their parents have issued statements saying how appalled they are by their own behavior and their own child's behavior. So it is sort of hard to imagine them then showing up in court.
Now, here's another view that's out there regarding most especially what's happened in Ferguson. It's from Rob. He says, police are not out shooting unarmed black choir boys. These people are putting themselves in a position to be shot by their own actions. Most of the time we learn they act aggressively toward police, we seem to conveniently never hear these facts.
Well, I think what that represents is a kind of the aggressive pushback on both sides that destroys the ability to have a conversation here. And obviously, in some cases, you know, Tamir Rice was shot, a 12-year-old boy, shot and killed by police, was doing nothing. So there are cases. I mean, so when things get when everybody's in their corners, one person says they're not choir boys, the other person, you know, you had these battle of anecdotes. I thought what was interesting about the Justice Department report is that on the one report about Ferguson, on the one hand, it was an exoneration of Officer Darren Wilson in a sense, but then also the Justice Department weighed in on the systemic racism in Ferguson. So the idea is you can have the facts of the case going one way and still have systemic racism, which is just an argument for the complexity of things and for the kind of patience and restraint required to have these conversations. The problem is when people are winging off shots at cops, nobody wants, rightly, to have any restraint. And when cops are shooting 12-year-olds that are doing nothing, no one wants to have restraint. And that is why this argument is so difficult to have. Discussion is so difficult to have.
Here's an email from Greta in Arlington. She says, I'm disappointed in you and your panel's comments. You say the president's response to the ambush shooting of police in Ferguson was strong. Surely you jest. The president's response was a tweet. It was perfunctory at best. And yet here he is. He said today, he was embarrassed. This is on another issue. Forgive me. Mr. Holder's comments were more strongly stated, but then he's the chief of law enforcement in this country. Do you agree the president's comments weren't strong enough, Karen?
Well, he was pretty clear on what he thought of this act. I don't know these days where the microphone is. But putting out a tweet actually gets your sentiments out there pretty quickly.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, John Prideaux of The Economist, John Dickerson of Slate Magazine, and CBS. Thank you all so much. Have a great weekend.
You
thanks,
too.
Sam. You too.
Thank you, and thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.